Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. With millions of people still out of work because of the pandemic, the U.S. Labor Department reported today that U.S. employers created only 266,000 jobs in April. President Biden waved off suggestions that the weaker-than-expected jobs numbers were disappointing as he tried to put the numbers into context.
Today's report just underscores, in my view, how vital the actions we're taking are. Checks to people who are hurting, support for small businesses, for child care and school reopening, support to help families put food on the table. Our efforts are starting to work, but the climb is steep, and we still have a long way to go.
And Florida and Texas are the latest states to move forward with voting restrictions. Those moves come as Republicans in Congress prepare to push the highest-ranking woman in their party out of her leadership role for continuing to call out former President Trump's false statements about election fraud. And for more, let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. And with us is Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good to be with you.
Yes, and Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Thanks for having me.
Rick, I'll start with you. The jobs numbers surprised many economists. Some had predicted a million jobs would be created as more people got vaccinated. But it's clear, of course, that this pandemic is not over yet. Do you think this will translate into a precarious political moment for President Biden?
There's no doubt that it's a disappointment, and I think the perceived strength of the economy is something that's been buoying the Biden presidency of late. You've got Republicans immediately saying, look, this shows the failure of these policies. You're putting too much money out there. You're not giving people an incentive to work. The flip side of that, though, is that Biden is using this as an argument for more stimulus to say, look, you can't look at these numbers and say we're spending enough. And we just heard from the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, as well, saying this shows that people need more support. They need childcare, for instance, to put themselves back on the workforce with schools not fully operational. So it's going to be added to a political mix, but any president would rather have a stronger economy than a weaker one, particularly at a time where so much of the Biden agenda is still to be enacted.
And President Biden is really pushing his infrastructure plan. Scott, Biden actually visited the red state of Louisiana to sell his plan to spend trillions of dollars on infrastructure that he says includes not just roads and bridges, but also things like expanded free education and childcare. The president says he's willing to cut a deal with Republicans on how much to raise corporate taxes and taxes on the wealthiest to pay for it.
What I'm not ready to do, I'm not ready to do nothing. I'm not ready to have another period where America has another infrastructure month and doesn't change a damn thing.
Scott, we hear what the president is saying, but are any Republicans feeling pressure to actually work with him on infrastructure?
Well, I'm not sure they're feeling pressure, but they are going to be having conversations this week with President Biden. President Biden's going to be hosting a number of Republicans in separate meetings. One of them is Shelley Morcapito of West Virginia. He has asked her to bring along whoever she wants to in terms of Republican senators who may be open to some kind of bipartisan deal. He's also going to be sitting down for the first time with Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy, the two top Republican leaders in the House and the Senate, in a meeting along with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. So the big four from Capitol Hill. So he's going through the motions and meeting with Republicans in this coming week and has been for the last few months. But he is really under a lot of pressure from progressives and even folks in his own White House who say, you know, because of these job numbers, because we can't let up on the gas, the country needs to go big in this moment and really push through a big infrastructure plan. And then maybe turn to some of that, what they're calling the family infrastructure after that. But they really feel like this is not a time to be, negotiating with Republicans and playing small ball. This is a chance for some transformational change and a chance to really go big.
Rick Klein, I want to talk to you about number three Republican leader Liz Cheney, who Tanya mentioned. She's the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney. Next week, she could very well lose her leadership role in Congress because she did not support Donald Trump when he claimed falsely that the election was stolen. So by not falling in line with her Republican colleagues, she's paying the price. Two questions about this. How many Republicans in Congress do you think genuinely believe the election was stolen? And for those Republicans who would normally stand behind Liz Cheney, are any standing behind her now?
Well, it's so interesting because one thing that some of Cheney's backers are saying right now is, let's not do this with a secret ballot. Let's go out in the open and say once and for all where you stand on this, because their suspicion is that there are members of Congress who are saying one thing publicly and another thing privately. I think it's impossible to know how many actually believe the falsehood, the lie that the election was stolen. I don't know that we know President Trump definitely believes that. I think there's a segment of members of Congress who believe that. I think there's a broader segment that realizes that there's more political peril in saying that, and an even larger number that says that, you know, whatever you think about that, that Liz Cheney and having her in leadership is counterproductive for the Republican Party right now because Donald Trump is angry about it, and that they need to go into the midterm elections as united as they are. And frankly, that means falling into line with Trump. It should be noted that Liz Cheney's perceived sin here is telling the truth and being consistent. When the people on the other side of this argument have lied about the election, or peddled falsehoods, whether they believe them or not, as well as been inconsistent about Cheney's role. It was the sense that she could stay in leadership. There was even a vote that happened just a couple of months ago after January 6th. And what Cheney has done is said, no, this is still a lie, and I'm going to continue to call it as such. And yeah, it's almost a foregone conclusion at this point that she's going to lose her job in leadership next week.
And Scott Wong, what does that cost Congress? Because Liz Cheney, has been a long and steadfastly conservative member of the party, and she backed extreme interrogation techniques against terrorism suspects, for one thing. Her likely replacement, Elsie Stefanik, has gone from moderate to conservative Republican, and she won Trump's endorsement this week. Let's hear from her first. She's on former Trump strategist Steve Bannon's War Room podcast yesterday.
I'm committed to being a voice and being sending a clear message that we are one team, and that means working with the president and working with all of our excellent Republican members of Congress.
So, Scott, when she says she wants to work with the president, that must come as a surprise to the president, Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, Stefanik has undergone a huge transformation. She came in as a moderate. She was actually one of the leaders of the moderate Tuesday group of Republicans. She voted against President Trump's 2017 tax cuts. She was seen as somebody who worked across the aisle. And then as her upstate New York district started trending towards Donald Trump after going twice for President Obama, she really grasped onto President Trump and was one of his chief defenders in the first 2019 impeachment trial, as well as the one just recently. And so, you know, she's facing now some criticism from the right. In fact, Stefanik is people saying that she's too moderate to replace Liz Cheney. People are holding up Cheney's conservative record and saying Stefanik doesn't compare to it if you look at some of the conservative scorecards. And so, you know, she has some convincing to do. But I think what this shows is that rather than conservative scorecards or conservative records in the Republican Party today, there's only really one thing that matters, and that is a loyalty to Donald Trump. And that's something that Stefanik has.
Right. And we should say, I think she was being loyal to Donald Trump when she referred to the president, because I think she was talking about working with him versus Joe Biden. I don't mm-hmm. know if, Rick, you have any thoughts about that and whether or not she actually has any significant future as a leader of the GOP.
Well, I mean, she's in her mid-30s. She's going to be the number three member of House leadership. There's a very good chance that the House Republicans take back control next year. I think she has a very bright future so far as Trumpism has a future. If it doesn't, she's made her play. And I think it's hard to walk back from this, from the history she had as a moderate and a Paul Ryan acolyte and someone who had a much more nuanced view, to say the least, of Donald Trump, to now being a full-on Trump loyalist. Trump's going to claim credit for elevating her to this position, and he won't be entirely wrong. And she's going to owe a lot of loyalty and a lot of debts to Trump and Trumpism moving forward.
We have just about a minute with both of you, but I want to talk about something. Last night, lawmakers in Texas advanced a bill that would do things like make it harder to get an absentee ballot. And yesterday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis barred local media from covering his signing into law of a similar voting restriction in his state. What is the bottom line here? Republicans need the Trump base to get reelected and advance politically, but does that eventually become a problem for them? Rick, I'll let you finish us out here.
Yeah, look, the through line is the big lie. And whatever reasons you have for reforming the voting systems and the voting eligibility processes in a state, the reason that it's happening in all these states is because Donald Trump lied about the last election and continues to do so. And you're seeing Trumpism's influence broader than even personnel. These are real policies that are going to impact people's lives and are going to change the way that people vote in some of the largest and most consequential states in the country.
That is Rick Klein, political director for ABC News, and Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Marlene Fine and Fern Johnson are steeped in the world of race relations. They've taught it as professors, Fine at Simmons University and Johnson at Clark University. And they've lived it. They are white, and together they adopted two African-American infant boys, now in their 30s. Their new book is called Let's Talk Race, A Guide for White People. They say whites need to have a deep conversation about what black people experience in America.
This is not known to most white people, so we have to learn it explicitly.
That's Fern Johnson. She grew up decades ago outside Minneapolis in Brooklyn Center. That's where Dante Wright was killed by police last month. Johnson's family was white and Christian, and she recalls an indelible experience from when she was a kid.
So our street and our whole suburb was white. And I remember that a black family moved down the street from us. And then it wasn't long after that when I was walking on the street and I realized that they were moving out. And so I had heard my parents talking about a meeting. My dad was going to a meeting about this family. And then I asked my parents, why did they move? I believe it was just my mother who answered the question. And she said, well, they moved because they would really be happier living someplace else.
Marlene, you, of course, didn't know Fern back then, but you were growing up in a Jewish family in New Jersey, and something similar happened.
Yes, very similar. So we moved to a community when I was 12 or 13 that was entirely white. And perhaps a year or two after we moved, my father told me that he had been invited to a meeting of other men in the town. And the meeting was ostensibly about how to keep a black family from buying a home in the community. My father didn't go to that meeting. But what I can tell you is that no black family ever bought a house in the town for as long as I lived there, and even for the years after I moved away while my parents were still living there.
What you do in the book is to encourage people to talk and to listen. One of the things you say is when you talk to a black person, don't expect them to set you straight on the entirety of the black American experience. So for those people who want to know the starting point, where do you even begin a conversation? Because I think a lot of people don't want to begin it because it feels so fraught. Any discussion about race feels fraught. And I think for a lot of white people, and you get to this in the book, people are afraid they're going to make a huge mistake.
Well, I think one of the first things that we all have to do as white people is simply learn more. And educating ourselves is a starting point. It's also important for us to talk to each other. If we do it with each other, there's a sense, I think, that we can make mistakes and be called to account for those mistakes with each other. We can get a better sense of our own thinking. So much of what we think about race is tacit. It's just understood. And we need to refine our ideas before we even start to think about talking across race with black people.
And in terms of talking with somebody who is black, there are do's and don'ts that you have. I know you want it to be used as kind of a handbook. You say, if a black person says, when a policeman wants me to pull over my car, I'm scared, if you're white, don't reply with, well, I'm scared too, you know, basically because I might get a ticket. What's wrong with saying that?
Because that essentially erases the experience of the Black person who has told you that, who has every reason to be afraid and to know that what they are experiencing and why they are afraid isn't the same as it is for a white person.
I mean, I remember the time that one of our sons was driving up to New Hampshire in a snowstorm. And when he arrived, he called us. His voice was shaking. He was practically in tears. He said that a state police officer had followed him the whole way, both tailing him and then pulling alongside him, staring at him, pulling back. And our son was terrified because he fundamentally believed that that police officer would pull him over and accuse him of something. And he knew that that could get out of control very quickly. That's simply not the case for most white drivers.
What happened, by the way?
A police officer finally pulled away as our son reached his destination. So nothing happened in that case. But our older son had a pretty bad interaction with a state police officer on the interstate, where he got pulled over for something that we'd never heard of anybody getting pulled over for, which was driving in the passing lane on an interstate highway. And he was then cited for three separate and different infractions. That one was not one of them.
So most of us who have driven for, you know, a few years or more, we have had experiences where we have spotted a police car behind us. And it's a kind of a panic moment. So it's very easy to say, oh, I've been followed too. I know exactly how you feel. No, you don't know, because it's a different experience, literally, and the consequences could be very different.
And if you want to establish that kind of common thread that Marlene was talking about, what do you say?
Well, I think what I would say is that you listen, and you listen closely, attentively, and you say something that demonstrates that you have understood that experience, not in the sense of I've had it too, but I am hearing you. I understand how serious that was, how afraid you might have been.
For anybody who feels like they're going to make a mistake, as they're talking to somebody from a different race, you say, okay, make a mistake. I mean, you both have.
Yes, I think that's a really great point, Lisa. We all make mistakes. We make them all the time. What's important is being able to own up to our mistakes. So if you say something that's hurtful to another person, it's really helpful to have said as a kind of ground rule guideline in your conversations that it's okay for the other person to say, whoops, that really hurt. And for you to then say, can you tell me why? And to really listen to what the other person has to say and be willing to say, I didn't know that, or I'm sorry that I said that, and I will work not to do that again. I'm going to try harder.
Or if you discover, you know, 5 minutes later in a conversation that something was wrong, just acknowledge it. Just say, oh, I said something 5 minutes ago that was wrong. I stand corrected, or I'm sorry I said it. Keep the conversation going rather than fall into silence.
We really want white people to understand that it's a constant process of learning and that we are learning all the time and we make mistakes all the time.
Well, thank you for telling us about your mistakes and your successes as well. Marlene Fine, Fern Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
Marlene Fine and Fern Johnson's new book is called Let's Talk Race, A Guide for White People.
Heads up, everybody. Part of a Chinese Long March rocket is going to crash down sometime this weekend somewhere on Earth. It's caught the eye of theoretical physicist Michio Kaku, who joins us now. Welcome.
Glad to be on the show.
This is a 10-story, 23-ton object. Let's first talk about why this is happening. Did something go wrong?
Well, we're not sure. Perhaps the Chinese got a little bit clumsy. But remember that they are roughly 30 years behind the West in technology. And 30 years ago, the great powers decided to deorbit booster rockets and large fragments of their satellite, deorbit them safely. But the Chinese apparently got careless, we're not sure, and this thing will land somewhere perhaps as far north as New York City and as far south as New Zealand. But it's anyone's guess where it's going to land up.
Is there any way to narrow down as it gets closer?
Not really, because you see, the atmosphere actually changes in height due to solar flares and temperatures, and it's sort of like skipping stone. You really never know when this stone is going to descend into a pond. In May of last year, there was another Long March rocket that also spiraled out of control. It had actually disintegrated over Africa and parts of the Ivory Coast.
Okay, so there is a chance that this could disintegrate before it actually hits land or water?
Chances are it's going to disintegrate over the ocean. However, there's a small probability that it'll land on somebody's backyard. For example, Skylab back in 1979, that was a 76-ton satellite. It broke up and landed in the Pacific and also Australia.
The probability, though, is very low that it could actually hit someone or hurt someone. But that's not out of the question.
Nobody has ever been killed or hit by a piece of space debris. But it does mean that we are in the target zone of this object because we simply cannot predict exactly where it's going to land. And that's why back in 1979, when Skylab fell down, Las Vegas bookmakers took bets as to where Skylab would eventually fall on the planet Earth.
Are you taking any bets for this one?
No, I'm not taking any bets. This is where science ends and speculation begins. We have 6,000 satellites in orbit, even as we speak. And it does mean that at some point, every single one will eventually come down. It's one of the byproducts of the space age.
Michio Kaku is professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York and author of The God Equation, The Quest for a Theory of Everything. Professor Kaku, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great honor.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
The monthly jobs report out today was a bit of a letdown for economists. They had predicted that the U.S. would pick up 1 million new jobs in April as more people got vaccinated. But the Labor Department said the number was actually much less, about 266,000. President Biden addressed the numbers and said it's clear we still have a long way to go.
You might think that we should be disappointed. But when we passed the American Rescue Plan, I want to remind everybody, it was designed to help us over the course of a year, not 60 days, a year.
Joining us now for more on these jobs numbers is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Happy Friday.
Oh, thanks. You too, Tanya.
Yeah. So what do you make of this big mismatch in the numbers? What's going on?
Yeah, it is remarkable. It is actually the biggest mismatch as far as a disappointment in the numbers based on the Bloomberg Economist surveys that we've done going back about 25 years. And the reasons for it are still being debated. One suspected cause is very technical. It's what's known as the seasonal adjustments. And what that means is that during the spring and the summer, there tend to be a lot more jobs outdoors. Anything from, say, construction or landscaping to amusement parks. So what the government does is they try to adjust the numbers in an effort to determine how many of those jobs actually are new as opposed to, say, the same seasonal jobs from last year. This is a really complicated process that often throws economists for a loop as far as when they make their predictions. And it's made a lot more complicated by the fact that if you look back to last April, right when all the lockdowns really began to hit the economy, the U.S. lost almost 21 million jobs last April alone. So that's really complicated the math here when doing these adjustments. But like I said, it's being debated as to whether that's the main reason. Another big issue is there was a drop in manufacturing jobs, and that's likely due to still remaining problems in the supply chain. For example, car makers just can't find the computer chips they need to make cars. So, Tanya, obviously that means fewer jobs in that sector.
Yeah. And what other sectors are where hiring is weaker right now? And maybe what sectors are people actually hiring for right now?
Yeah, so it very much tracks the kind of reopening of the economy trend. For example, leisure and hospitality, it's a big category that includes jobs in bars and restaurants and hotels and casinos. That was a big standout with an increase of 331,000 jobs in the month. The flip side of that coin, though, is that the category of couriers and messengers fell by 77,000 jobs. And that likely reflects the fact that people are shopping more at retail stores rather than ordering online and going to restaurants rather than getting delivery. So a lot of those delivery jobs were eliminated last month.
I have just about 30 seconds with you. What will the Biden administration be weighing, you think, in the coming weeks and months ahead to improve this jobs picture? We heard the president speak a little bit earlier about, you know, the jobs rescue plan is supposed to be a year, not 60 days.
Right. So I think the big problem right now is there are a ton, millions of unfilled job openings out there. So I think they really need to get people more comfortable about the risk of the virus, get more people vaccinated, and a lot more of those jobs will be filled, and we'll see those job numbers looking better as the year goes on.
Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, as always. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Lisa.
More than 25 years ago, the group Soli Canto hit the music scene with exciting and unbridled dance rhythms from all across Latin America, and soulful ballads, too. Concerts were bilingual, and the joy and intimacy in the performances made them feel like family affairs. Well, now Soli Canto has released an album called En Vivo en Familia, or Live in the Family, that celebrates a quarter of a century of music, and it is a family affair. The group's founders, Rosie and Brian Amador, are joined by their 25-year-old daughter, Elisa Amador. If Elisa's name sounds familiar, it's because her star is rising in the indie music scene. She was even featured in an NPR Tiny Desk contest last year. As mom Rosie tells us, this album is far from the first time the family has sung as one.
Back when Elisa and her twin were seven, we recorded a children's album together.
We then, were the built-in backup
that's
singers.
Right.
Free child labor. <That's right>. Family business.
But here's the thing. Fun. They took off musically on their own. Elisa started composing at age 15 and performing. Mm-hmm. And we made this album because she has one foot out the door already. Had it not been for the pandemic, she would be on the road constantly. And we really wanted to create something with her that included all of the songs that she had been singing with us for some time. And then we finally did it. So it's a huge celebration of our togetherness as a family. And in a way, it's also a launching of Elisa into her own path.
And I want to talk about that, Elisa, with you, because you're drawing a lot of attention on the indie music scene. And your voice, Elisa, is so beautiful, and it's different from your mom's.
You.
And I wonder, let's hear a little bit right now of one of the songs on the album that you wrote, Elisa, Home Again.
I made myself some tea, and I sat upon the rug, braided years before.
Elisa, what's the inspiration for the song?
I wrote this song as I was packing up my college dorm room, preparing to move in with my family for the first time as a young adult. At first, it just seemed like a little portrait of me moving out. And then that line came, this rug that was braided years before, I was a twinkle in your eye. And my parents always say that, especially when I was younger. They said, oh, when we first started Soli Canto, when you were a twinkle in our eye and we toured here and there. And so that came, it had been floating around, I guess, in my memory. And it came out in that moment as I prepared to move back home, but as a young adult this time, and just a really poignant time. And it felt really right to put that on the album and for them to learn how to sing it with me.
So what do you say I come home again and I leave these old books behind?
wonder what it was like, Rosie, for you as Elisa's mom to be learning a song that your daughter wrote and singing along with her.
That's a great question, Lisa. Because Elisa has been singing and composing for so long, and I've fallen in love with so many of her songs, when she invited us to sing along, I just felt so honored and excited, because there's nothing more exciting than being able to sing on your daughter's song, just as she has accompanied us on so many songs for so many years. So kind of, you know, what goes around comes around.
And this takes us to the song Amaras. This was written by Brian, your husband, Rosie, and your father, Elisa. Yes. Let's hear a bit of it.
O tal vez no, tal vez no. O tal vez no llegues a encontrar tu alma gemela.
O tal vez no,
tal vez tu media naranja resulte limón.
This is a song in the rhythm of bolero, Cuban bolero, that Brian wrote for our twins. Amaras means you will love. And the verse, one of the important verses, says, you will love, and the object of your love won't always deserve it. You'll cry, and maybe from your tears will spring a new enchantment. Or maybe not. Maybe.
Or maybe, you didn't, I was going to say the next line, or maybe your better half turns out to be a lemon.
That's right. You like got
his,
it.
I like his realism. And singing together like this, what is it like now versus what it was like before Elisa, before you broke out on your own?
It's quite surreal.
It is.
I have to say, having been born into this band and this lifestyle, knowing every nuance of what happens behind the stage and every minute of the work that my parents put into creating a performance and really understanding the ins and outs of being a musician and crafting a concert, and they really taught me everything I know. So to come back after college and to create this album together where we're really both coming at it as full people.
That's
and
it.
Approaching the music with all of our heart. It's just really beautiful, and I'm so grateful it was recorded.
You guys are mother and daughter. Don't you ever argue?
Oh, yeah.
Never.
What?
Jamás.
See, we've already argued on this interview. We're already disagreeing. No, we drive each other crazy sometimes.
Sometimes, but not often, I have to say.
No.
We're both pretty open-hearted and good communicators, and we know that to solve any problem, you just have to be real.
Yeah,
you
and yell at each other a little.
Every now and then.
And then hug.
Exacto.
But when you're working together, I mean, are you ever tempted, Elisa, to actually say to your incredibly proficient mother, I'd rather have you sing it this way? Or same thing with Rosie. I mean, you know,
oh, yeah.
Do you ever say, yes, darling, that's beautiful, but...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
We have very open discussions about arrangements.
When you're in a band together, you just have to get comfortable with that, or else you would never get through a rehearsal.
I wonder if you can give us an example of how you find a harmony that works in your individual styles. Is there something you could just give us 30 seconds of?
Let's see. Can we think of something?
Tonada.
Tonada, in which we sing in our individual styles?
Tonada de luna llena.
Yeah.
And I know Brian is nearby.
Shall I put the headphone on him?
Just for a sec, yeah.
Hello.
Hey, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing?
It's so nice to talk to you. Congratulations on the 25 years and on the album. I'm just wondering if you can direct your daughter and your wife in a bit of harmony, and you can even join it, your family is so fond of and does so beautifully.
Okay, well, let me get a note and we'll try that.
Okay. We'll just do a little snippet here, right?
Okay. Yep.
Yo vi de una garza pobre dándole combate al río. Así es como se enamora tu corazón con el mío. Yo vi de una garza mora dándole combate a un río. Así es como se enamora. Así es como se enamora. Tu corazón con el mío, tu corazón con el mío.
That was amazing.
Oh, good. We were going to keep going, and I had to decrescendo us.
Oh, no. We'll have to save the crescendo. I just want to thank all of you, the three of you, and wish you, Rosie, a happy Mother's Day.
Thank
you. I don't know,
you.
Elisa, are you a mother?
Not yet, but I do want to say to my mom, thank you so much for being my mother, for raising me, and for teaching me how to just completely give myself to this craft and for supporting me through it all. You've taught me so much just by being.
So proud of you and so happy for you. Thank you so much for having us, Lisa. Congratulations.
Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mother and daughter Rosie and Elisa Amador and dad Brian. Soli Canto's latest album is called En Vivo en Familia. This family never stops making music. Both Soli Canto and Elisa Amador have EPs coming out soon. For more information, go to hereandnow.org.
Twenty-four states are now fighting the Sackler family's attempt to seek immunity for their role fueling the opioid epidemic. The Sackler family owned Purdue Pharma, which sold OxyContin, and a new documentary is tracing how Purdue Pharma and other drug makers sparked the ongoing opioid crisis. It's called Crime of the Century, and it premieres this Monday on HBO. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us for more. And Eric, let's hear from a deposition that Richard Sackler gave in a lawsuit a few years ago. He was Purdue Pharma's chairman back then and promoted opioids even as fatal overdoses were on the rise.
There is no drug that is more effective or safer than opioids for treating pain over the long term.
Eric, how does this documentary draw that line between the opioid crisis and the Sackler family?
Well, basically, it's making the point that Richard Sackler in particular was involved in marketing the drug to doctors and encouraging them to overprescribe it, to prescribe it not just for people who were in severe pain, but to prescribe it for a much wider form of ailments like back pain and muscle pain and things like that. And the contention, of course, is that they created a billion-dollar industry in this marketing, and they enriched their own family, something to the tune of $13 or $14 billion. But they also created a huge problem with addiction to opioids.
This documentary is called Crime of the Century. Does it make a convincing argument that there were a legal crossing of lines?
Sure. For example, it's in two parts. So the first part of the documentary talks a lot about Purdue Pharma, which developed OxyContin and sort of pioneered a lot of these marketing techniques. But then once they revealed that there was a market there, other smaller companies also got involved. They even would create these promotional videos to convince people that opioids would solve their pain issues but wouldn't lead to any negative consequences. And so in the documentary, they have a salesman from one of these companies talking about one of these videos. Let's check it out.
They had a video called I Got My Life Back. I played many a times in physicians' offices, sort of humanized the idea of treating pain patients.
Since I've been on this new pain medication,
I'm more of a partner to my husband again.
Now I can go to a movie.
I'm still alive.
And so you get a sense from watching this documentary of how the system worked, which was it was important for these powerful drugs, which were normally used for very small markets, you know, people who were at the end of life to make their life easier as they were passing away, try to expand the use of those drugs to people who had a wider range of ailments so that then you could prescribe OxyContin for back pain, or you could prescribe it for depression, or you could prescribe it for people who were recovering from other things. And it would expand the number of people it could be prescribed to, which would then expand, of course, the amount of sales that you would have.
Mm-hmm. How these drugs were marketed is really the basis of this documentary. How do you think it will impact the current climate that we're in regarding all of what we've learned about the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma and really opioids and the opioid epidemic overall?
Well, you know, one key component, for example, of the problem is that the pharmaceutical companies tried to remove direct personal responsibility for what they did from the equation. And so I think the struggle now, for example, is to try and get the Sackler family to personally be found liable and perhaps criminally liable for some of the things that the company did. And if you can create a situation where the people running these companies might go to jail for what they're doing, then that might be the ultimate discouragement.
Well, Eric, before I let you go, let's talk about one thing that's a little lighter, and that's Disney Plus's release of their new Star Wars show, The Bad Batch. Star Wars fans will know what I'm talking about when I say it's about these clone troopers going rogue as Emperor Palpatine sets up the Galactic Empire. This is an animated show. How does it compare to live action shows like The Mandalorian?
Well, it's interesting. You know, what we've seen on Disney Plus is they've had a lot of success in creating these series that take characters that don't get a lot of screen time in big movies and using them to tell really compelling stories. So what this animated show does is kind of build out the Star Wars universe a little bit more. And because it's an animated show and it's on Disney Plus, and I think they know that young people are going to wind up watching it, it's not as bloody or as explicit as even a show like The Mandalorian was. And it may feel a little simplistic to some adult viewers, but I think people who are deep fans will find a lot of storytelling elements that they love. And people who are casual fans will learn a lot more about the Star Wars universe. I had a really good time watching this.
Oh, this sounds great. Something both me and my son can watch together.
It is on Disney Plus right now. So you can watch the initial episode now.
Well, there we go. Well, thank you. That is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.